From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. In Georgia, the red could become the blue.
My team tells me that if young people come out at twice the rate that they are expected to in a special election like this, that we'll win. So it is all up to y'all.
That is Democrat John Ossoff appealing to younger voters from Georgia's 6th congressional district. Next Tuesday is Election Day. Polls will open Saturday as well for early voting, and we'll look at why people across the country are watching the 6th. First, though, yesterday we heard from the man behind Puddles, the sad clown with the beautiful voice.
People are really seem to be very, very affected by it. Some people are get kind of squirmy about it, but he seems to be really resonating with a really wide, diverse group of people.
That's Atlanta-based singer and band leader Mike Geyer. He created Puddles the Clown, and here are your first thoughts. Tony tweets, clowns are looked at as scary, not something that will cheer or make you laugh. And Nick Garrett says, sad clowns? No real opinions. Augusta has a pretty famous happy one, though. Pretty talented artist, too. She takes her work very seriously. We always want to know more if you're telling us. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter like Nick and Tony did. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Cobb County is the last white majority metro county in Georgia, but it's expected to become majority minority over the next 4 years. More than 50% of its residents will not be white. Cobb is part of the now nationally famous 6th Congressional District. It will elect a new congressperson next Tuesday, and some polls suggest the traditionally Republican district might flip from red to blue. So to talk about all of this, we have Andra Gillespie with us once again, political science professor at Emory University. It's great to have you back, Andra.
Thank you for having me.
Do pollsters make a mistake? Do analysts make a mistake if they assume that becoming more diverse means becoming less Republican?
They aren't making a mistake in principle. Where the mistakes happen is in terms of what the temporal projection will be. So just because a state is becoming increasingly diverse doesn't mean that all of a sudden its partisan politics are instantly going to flip. So you have to take a much longer view of what that looks like. So in the case of Cobb County or Gwinnett County or the state of Georgia writ large, you have to factor in whether or not people are registered to vote, and that can account for citizenship patterns. And then you also have to give people time to acclimate to the political system and to get involved in politics. The other thing that's also really important is that if those demographics are largely driven by higher birth rates in minority communities, and you're looking at when young people are aging into the system, their levels of turnout in young adulthood are typically lower than what they're going to be in middle age. And so if you're banking on a group of young minorities being the swing vote in highly contentious political races like the one that we're experiencing right now, that is overly ambitious usually. And so I would just caution people to not count on 18-year-olds to be the margin of victory in a race. Rather, you need to look at 35-year-olds and 40-year-olds when people are acclimated to voting and tend to be more likely to exercise their franchise.
So then let's talk about priorities for different groups. This is a couple moments from the first debate that it was held last week between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican Karen Handel. They were asked about whether they support a so-called living wage, an increase in the minimum wage.
Yes, I do. The minimum wage should be a living wage. I think we can raise it indexed to the cost of living because the cost of living varies widely in urban and rural areas and in different states across this country.
I do not support a livable wage. What I support is making sure that we have an economy that is robust with low taxes and less regulation so that those small businesses that would be dramatically hurt if you impose higher minimum wages on them are able to do what they do best.
So, Andra, in past years in Cobb County, an answer like that Karen Handel gave would have been in line with many of the voters' opinions, which were very pro-business, very much pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Why did she get in so much trouble for that answer?
It was because of the semantics and the wording. So I was at WSB during that debate, and everybody who was watching with me before we went on online for post-debate analysis kind of jolted after we heard that. And I think it was because the wording that she used misspoke. Like, I understood what she meant to say. She meant to say that this is a burden on small businesses who are then forced to pay artificially high minimum wages and thus can't hire as many people to help them do their jobs, and that's going to impede their growth. And that's still debatable, and that probably still resonates with part of the district. But the fact that she said, I do not support a livable wage, was what was, I think, very jarring to many people, and that that was potentially galvanizing for Ossoff supporters and for people who are on the left. Because it, when people say livable wage, then that suggests that perhaps you don't support a minimum wage. And definitely there are economic conservatives who don't think the market should help define sort of what people's wages are. But to say that you want working people to live below the poverty line could come across as very mean-spirited.
To what extent is the change that we're seeing in Georgia 6? Look, even if John Ossoff loses, it's fair to say that we didn't expect the 6th district to be competitive. That's fair?
Well, you know what? I think that this race is idiosyncratic, and in a larger context, if this race were being held in November, it would be more competitive than it was last November because you don't have a long-term incumbent running for re-election. So in the context of it being an open race, it was naturally going to be more competitive. That's why you saw so many people enter the race. And I think given the polarization that we are experiencing in our country today and the anger met by the joy that some people feel at the election of Donald Trump, it is not surprising that people are engaged. And then also because this race is an incubator race for both parties to test mobilization and outreach strategies, they have an incentive to pour a lot of resources into the race, which helps to make the race appear to be more competitive, and I think it helps to make the race more competitive. That actually sort of, you know, is this nice kind of conflagration of factors that make this race particularly interesting. If this were, a November race, this would probably still be one of the more competitive districts, but then they would be competing with the roughly 24 other highly competitive congressional races that are coming up, and so it wouldn't get the same type of attention.
All right, let's hear another couple answers from that debate between Karen Handel and John Ossoff. In this case, they were asked about the funding for their campaigns, and I should mention that at this point, the 6th District congressional race is the most expensive of its kind in history.
My campaign is funded by small-dollar grassroots fundraising. The average contribution to my campaign is less than $50, and that's from folks across the country, but also far more Georgians than have contributed to my opponent's campaign.
There are super PACs and outside groups funding both of these campaigns, but let's be clear, what's really fueling all the money in this is the fact that my opponent has more donors and more dollars coming from outside of the state of Georgia. He doesn't want the people of Georgia to know that he is a liberal Democrat. He is supported by the most liberal elements of the Democratic Party.
So what is the cause of the expense? Is it because, as you say, this is sort of an incubator for what's going to happen in the rest of the country?
It's part incubation. It's part people on both sides are motivated because of the political climate to participate in the race, and this provides them an outlet to be able to show their support for President Trump or to vent their frustration at President Trump. And then also because there are parties and third-party groups and super PACs that are actually in the business right now of trying to figure out what their strategy is going to be for 2018. And so that's the incubation part, where they're using this as an opportunity to test certain theories, to test new modes of outreach. And so that costs money. And so they're just using this basically as kind of research and development.
But here we have some pretty dramatically changing demographics in Georgia. Atlanta is actually becoming more white. The suburbs are becoming more non-white. And in some ways, Georgia is a precursor of what's going to happen around the country. We're seeing these demographic changes here, and demographers expect it to happen in other states in the years to come. Does that have any effect, do you think, on Georgia? Is it fair to say that becoming less white in Georgia means that Georgia is turning purple?
Again, it's not necessarily going to be immediate. And so I'm going to use Gwinnett County kind of as an example. Gwinnett County is further along in terms of its diversification. However, right now, whites still control the majority of the political offices that are held in the county. Some people will argue that has a lot to do with gerrymandering, So it takes time. There's a lag between the demographic changes actually materializing within an area and political power actually shifting hands or becoming more diverse, or a district becoming more descriptively representative, if you will. So part of it is going to be structural. So our districts drawn in a way that minority voters actually have the ability to be able to cast their vote in a meaningful way. So it doesn't mean that we're trying to game the system to, you know, guarantee with 100% certainty that you're always going to get a minority representative. But our districts drawn in a way that would actually preclude them from actually being able to play a decisive vote in any particular area. And then there's the question of turnout. So if you see differential turnout rates across different groups, then the group that turns out more is actually going to have more of an influence on the outcome of elections and the outcome of politics in that area.
So what are you looking for, especially in Cobb County, that might tell you more about what's happening with politics in Georgia? Can we take a message, for example, from the 6th District about who may win the governor's office?
Well, I mean, you know, I think looking at county politics as a whole when you're running in a statewide race is interesting. So the fact that Hillary Clinton won Cobb County in 2016 is something that's really important. In this congressional race, remember, Cobb County is split between the 6th and the 11th district. So groups tend to also concentrate in different parts of the county. So the overall county demographics changes are not going to be fully reflected in this district that actually traverses 3 different counties. But it perhaps is definitely a harbinger of things to come. As this race is being used as an incubator to test out outreach strategies, I think it's also important to know that this is still an apples-to-orange comparison between a special election and a general election, where your electorate splits different demographically, and just where the context in which candidates are running looks a little bit different. So I think we have to be cautious of that. But suffice to say, Georgia is changing, and whether or not that change manifests itself in purple politics or even Democrats winning high-profile seats in places they haven't won them before now or 5 to 10 years from now, it is partially a function of the changes that we see happening in terms of who's moving where.
So in the last minute that we have, Andra, is Georgia in any way a bellwether for the rest of the South? Can we take lessons from both the demographic and political changes happening here and apply them to other southern states?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. And so I think that this could potentially work both ways. So there are ways that that Georgia is going to be different. But you can, I think the cautionary tale is looking at what demographics look like in other parts of the South. So, for instance, in the Deep South, other deep southern states like Mississippi and Alabama, for instance, where you have, for instance, large African-American populations, and you have had large African-American populations, you know, for a long, long time, you don't see the same level of political incorporation for those groups. And so that's the cautionary tale, that numbers don't necessarily translate into political power, which means you also have to look at structural issues. So in Georgia, the structural conditions may be more favorable for minorities able to run and get elected. And so in that respect, that is different. But then you also need to divide the South up regionally and think about what's the difference between the Deep South and the Upper South.
Andra Gillespie is a political science professor at Emory University. It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Andra.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what's on the mind of voters in rural Georgia? First, though, we'll talk about the future of Atlanta's electorate and the Beltline. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Atlanta's demographics are in flux. A new study from Georgia State University took a very comprehensive look at the metro area over the past 45 years, and it found the city is more diverse, more educated, and more wealthy than ever before. That's good news. The bad news is the city has lost 5% of its affordable housing units every year since 2012. With us to talk about this is Ryan Gravel. He's the founder of Atlanta's Beltline. Now he heads up the Atlanta City Design Project. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Allison Johnson is a member of the Housing Justice League. That group advocates for affordable housing and tenant protections. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
And also with us is Andy Schneggenberger, right?
That's right.
An affordable housing advocate and developer in Atlanta. He serves on the Beltline Affordable Housing Advisory Board. Hi, Andy.
Good morning.
it's hard to know where to start because there's so much packed into some of these changes happening. But let me start with one of the most basic questions that I hear often when we talk about things like gentrification and demographic changes, which is, what's wrong with gentrification? And I'm going to let you all take a stab at this. Because when you look at the statistics and it says, I'm not even talking about race here, I'm just talking about the fact that Atlanta residents are wealthier, that they're more educated, that often they're business owners. Why is that a bad thing? Ryan?
Well, it's not the same people. I mean, I think you have to, I don't even like the word gentrification. If we talk about economic displacement, we talk about cultural displacement, I think those are more specific kinds of terms. And so, you know, they might be more educated, more wealthy, but it's a different group of people than the people who have been living here for so long.
You mean we're booting one group of people out and replacing them?
Yes.
Allison, do you want to add to that?
It's not like people are just getting new jobs and, you know, being entrepreneurs and building generational wealth for themselves. I mean, there is some of that, of course, but I mean, primarily, it's a different group of people.
I agree. It's totally a different group of people that comes into the communities that for generations people have held down through the lean of things. And when things are changing and the market is directing people in a different direction, it's not okay to displace or remove people that have been in these communities forever.
Why isn't it okay?
Because people who have been in these communities deserve to stay in these communities. They have built these communities. They have families. They live, work, worship, play in these communities and have been for years. They've been screaming for economic development, for equitable, affordable housing in these communities for decades. And it's not okay when people come in and just decide this is where they want to reside. And we don't know for how long. But these are people's lives and people's families that have lived here for generations. And they deserve the right to remain in their communities without people dictating when they should move away from their communities.
And Andy, why, I mean, whatever your feelings may be about the term gentrification, when it comes to a city itself, why would a city want to battle gentrification? Why not feed into it so you bring in wealthier individuals?
Well, I think that's sort of the market dynamic, right?
Right.
I mean, you want to increase your tax base. You want to improve
right.
the quality of life in communities, right? But I think the primary challenge for gentrification and the reason why it stirs up the passions is that for lower-income folks, people that don't have resources, it happens involuntarily, right? They don't have a choice. And as Allison mentioned, people, when they've been living in a community for a while, that's home, right?
Right.
And to be faced with a situation where suddenly you cannot live there anymore because you can't afford to for reasons that are beyond your control, market forces that are coming in and changing the situation where you don't have the ability to adapt, to stay, to figure out, you know, how to make it work for your household or your family, you have to leave. That's the problem, I think.
Let's hear this comment from Georgia State sociology professor Deirdre Oakley when she was talking about redevelopment and how that drives residents out of a neighborhood, which is really what we're talking about.
If you own a home and you're of a modest income and property values are going up all around you, you might think that this is a good thing in terms of equity in your house. But if you can't afford the increased taxes, you can have a lien put on your house, and then you can't sell it. So it puts people in a situation where they just can't afford to live there. If you're renting a property and the landlord has to pay extra taxes, it means that your rent is going to go up so the landlord can pay the taxes.
Now, we have two people here who are connected in some way with the Beltline. And it looks from the research that we have that the Beltline is driving some of this increase in property taxes. It is unintentionally forcing some people out of their houses. So let me talk with you first, Ryan, about how we can, do we have a moment here to stop that from happening?
Yes. I want to be clear, though, that it's not the Beltline that's pushing people out. It's the economic forces that are around the Beltline that are creating these challenges. You know, it's not like the Beltline is literally going around pushing people out of their houses.
Right.
And the other piece is that the economic forces, this isn't rocket science. This is happening everywhere. Every city across the country, the Beltline may shape the geography of where those pressures are happening in Atlanta. It may shape the amplification of it in some locations, but it's not unique to the Beltline. It's not unique to Atlanta. And so it's important to understand that the challenge is the economic forces. And, you know, the answer is not to not improve communities. The answer is not to not build trails and parks and grocery stores and attract jobs. That's not the answer, to hold communities down just to keep them affordable. We have to, that's why I want to be very specific about the term gentrification. Like, we need, if the problem is economic, then we need to address those economic problems directly. And there are lots of solutions. Again, it's not rocket science. You talk to Andy and other housing experts, everybody, you know, Allison, we know what the answers are. We're just not doing it. And so there's a lot of room for new people. You talk about attracting new people to the city. That's great. We have a lot of room for a lot more people. But it just can't come at the expense of the people who are here, the people who made this attractive place and to live in all this over all these years.
Andy, what kind of power do you have? I mean, you are with the Housing Justice League. Allison is with the Housing Justice League, but you're on the Beltline Affordable Housing Authority, right? I mean, you're on the board there. What kind of power do you have to protect land property owners and tenants?
None. The Beltline Affordable Housing Advisory Board is, the last two words in that title are the most important. I think it's an advisory board, right? We give recommendations to how the dollars that are in the Beltline Affordable Housing Trust Fund might be used. Those recommendations may or may not be accepted and put into practice. But if I may, I'd like to comment on the, you know, your prior question. I believe it's about embracing a strategy of managing improvements in quality of life and the economic factors that Ryan was talking about in a way that ensures that we can have mixed income communities going forward. Because we know that there's particular value for having that kind of diversity in a community, right? It's better for educational outcomes. It increases quality of life for everybody across the board. There are real...
Actually, it lowers your heart rate. It extends your life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, pick a demographic, a benefit, right? A metric. And in general, they're positive across the board from a mixed income community perspective, right? And that's what gentrification seems to work against, right? When a tidal wave of improving property values and increased property taxes sort of pushes things in a community so quickly that there isn't generally, typically, in the way we sort of approach these things now anyways, there's not an effort to, a real concerted effort anyways, to kind of reverse the engineering of that somehow and ensure that there's the retention of some affordability in a neighborhood so that there can be a mixed income community.
Or it doesn't happen fast enough. The market moves faster than that.
Right, yes.
Which brings us to you, Allison. In April, we actually spoke to some of the people that were protesting redevelopment plans at Turner Field. So let's take a listen to one of them.
My name is Queen Evelyn Clemens, and I'm a resident here in Mechanicsville since 1964. I was living right here on Windsor Street at the FedEx building, where it's right here now. My grandfather, Henry Reed, and my grandmother, Willie Mae Reed, was living there, and that was 1964 when I was born. So I want to be a part of the movement. I definitely don't want to be pushed out, and I don't want them to be pushed out just because they're not here to be heard.
So what are these solutions, Allison? How do we protect Queen Evelyn Clements?
Well, I think a couple of things that I just want to, I may have to go back just a little bit. I'm seventh generation in People's Town, and we originally came from Buttermilk Bottoms. And my family was...
Where was Buttermilk Bottoms?
It's right where people call the old 4th Ward now. It's right at the bottom.
It's under the Civic Center.
Yeah, under the Civic Center. And my grandfather was living there. He was a butler for a family in Ansley Park. And they were displaced and moved right up the street onto Boulevard where old 4th Ward is now. And then they were displaced by the highways, only to move into Summerhill and were displaced by the Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. So here we are again. So to keep folks like Evelyn, myself, my children in those communities, there's got to be some type of equitable development that is going to allow for long-term residents to be transformative from rental into home ownership. And when I say that, and people are always thinking we're just talking about 0 to 30% of the affordability range, I'm talking about the housing affordability that is affordable to people at all income levels. But the most need that is unmet, and we've got to be honest, is 0 to 30%. And a lot of people who've been there for a long time.
0 to 30% of what?
Of the area median income. And a lot of people who are talking about being displaced, who are actually being threatened by displacement, are those people who are making or income, earning incomes in those ranges. And we are going to be the most vulnerable people to be pushed out of these communities. So we've got to be able to have access to affordable houses. We've got to have access to being able to manage our property taxes for those who are earning or at a fixed income who are not going to be able to pay their property taxes, as you've just seen the assessments that's just come out. So we've got to be able to make sure that there's retention there. And it's got to be a focused area on long-term residents as well.
Right. And what you're referring to is the fact that a number of property tax bills just came and people were stunned to see how high they were. Some people cannot pay those. Let's hear one more Atlanta resident who is demonstrating at Turner Field in April.
My name is Susan Taylor. I'm here because I have been a member of the People's Town Summerhill community for a long time. I've experienced several different kinds of urban renewal and gentrification efforts that have never made way for the people who live here.
So, Ryan, is there a solution to that? The city says about those property tax bills, look, the property values went up. You know, we don't influence the assessments. That's what the assessment is. The houses are worth more. The property taxes are higher. How do you solve that?
You get a room full of all the housing experts in the city who I'm not among them and get the answer. I mean, there's lots of answers to that. There are lots of things that we do here that other counties do across the region, that other cities do across the country. There are answers to those. I'm not the housing expert.
Right, but you're coming down to design it. And can you design a city so these problems don't arise?
The real issue is that we have to set an aspiration and vision for our city that includes everybody, that we fall in love with a vision for ourselves and for this place that we live that includes everybody. And then if we love that and if we want that, then follow through on those aspirations and all the really hard work that it will take to achieve it. But if you look at Atlanta's contribution to the world, which is the legacy of the civil rights movement, it is our modern identity as a city. It is the foundation on which all of our economic and cultural prosperity has happened to date. That's why Atlanta has been successful. We owe it to that. We have an opportunity and an obligation to live up to that promise, what Dr. King called the beloved community, which I know is getting a lot of people talking about it right now, but that is our greatest sort of aspiration. It's going to be hard, but it's also possible. And there are just things that we have to do. And the economic forces that we're talking about are the most powerful and urgent, especially, as Allison said, for people who are at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. We just have to do it. And in order to do it, then we all as individuals, as residents, as communities, have to speak up and ask our elected officials and our corporate business leaders and everybody else to advocate for that vision, for that future. We can do it. We just have to do it.
That's Ryan Gravel of the Atlanta City Design Project. We also spoke with Allison Johnson, who's a member of the Housing Justice League and a member of the People's Town Summerhill community that we've been hearing from. And Annie Schneggenberger is an affordable housing advocate and developer in Atlanta. If your neighborhood has changed, do you like the changes that have come to you? We'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us, you know that, at OST Talk, or just call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Ryan and Andy and Allison, thank you all so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Driving in Atlanta can be torture, so it might surprise you to learn Georgia drivers are not the worst in the country. Rhode Island actually owns that title. But we are among the worst when it comes to two things, braking and accelerating. We're the only southern state in the bottom five for those particular skills. New research also shows male drivers are 11% more likely than females to make risky decisions when it comes to using the gas pedal. So we took to the streets of Atlanta we walked, to ask people what driving habits really irk them.
Hi, my name is Mariah McKenzie. I've noticed that a lot of people tend to drive much slower than the speed limit for no reason, and then cause traffic.
My name is Robert Lofton. I can't stand when people texting on the phone.
My name is Max McFarland. I suppose people who are going to turn and pull up and cut in at the last minute, it's just flat dangerous.
We always love to know what you think, and I bet you have a lot of thoughts about Georgia's drivers and Georgia roads. So tell us what really bothers you when you're behind the wheel. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Earlier this week, we talked about an investigation into lead contamination in Georgia's water. The discussion about lead in public water systems got a lot of attention after the Flint water crisis, and five health officials in Michigan were recently charged with manslaughter in connection with that crisis. So tomorrow in the break room, we'll ask whether that was a good thing or prosecutorial overreach. And you can give us your opinion. Is it okay for the health officials to get charged with manslaughter? Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on social media, and we might feature your comments on the show. Just remember to join us for that discussion tomorrow morning at 9. We talked earlier about Georgia's changing demographics and the effect on neighborhoods and on elections. The whole Georgia voting process has come under a lot of scrutiny in recent years. The Daily Yonder, which is a news website, compared investigations into voting violations in rural and urban areas of the state. Reporter Tim Merrima found rural voters undergo a disproportionate share of state elections board's investigations. Frankly, rural voters are twice as likely to get investigated in Georgia than urban voters. And Tim is with us from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Celeste.
Also with us is Atlanta-based voting rights consultant Fred McBride. Thanks for having you.
Good morning.
Fred, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, Tim, what exactly, did you get any sense of what is driving the higher number of investigations into rural voters as opposed to urban?
Well, that's the question. I mean, I did document by looking at specific cases over the last 2 years in 2015 and 2016 that there was a disproportionate number of citations coming from rural areas. And as you said, it was about twice the rate. I don't have a definitive answer. One thing I did hear was that it had to do with resources and how well trained and how much time there was for training and money at the precinct level in these individual counties.
Fred, one of the people, at least, that Tim spoke with absolutely denied that there was a difference in training. How much can training of precinct workers make a difference? How much effect does that have?
I really don't think it has that much of an effect. I do understand and appreciate the fact that resources are spent on training and poll workers do need to be trained. But I don't really think you need to train a poll worker to go over and tell someone, I'm sorry, ma'am or sir, you can't do that. I can't see there being that much emphasis on someone just doing a very basic task of just informing someone that they can or cannot do something. I really think that's a scapegoat.
So, Tim, he's kind of obliquely referring to a case which is in the courts right now. So tell us the story about this grandmother who went to help her nephew vote. He was 18 years old. She went to go help him vote. Why is she now being charged?
You're talking about Olivia Pearson?
Correct.
Douglas, which is in Coffee County, and she is a politically active woman who is known to help people get to the polls. She assisted different voters and then was asked to sign a form explaining why she did that. In her opinion, it was business as usual. This was something she was accustomed to doing. And from the state's point of view, she falsified an affidavit explaining the reason for her assisting that voter. And Fred knows more about this, but the case resulted in a mistrial on the first time around, and I believe is scheduled for another trial later in the year. And also, not only is she politically active, she is also a member of the city commission.
Fred, where does Ms. Pearson's case stand, and why is it important when it comes to voting law in Georgia?
As it was indicated earlier, it was a mistrial in March. The county is pursuing a second trial, which is scheduled for mid-August.
Is that just one particular case as far as you're concerned? Is this just about her, or does this have implications?
I think, in my opinion, it has implications. There were four individuals indicted for assisting voters that year. The other three took a plea. City Commissioner Olivia Pearson said she didn't do anything wrong. She didn't take the plea, and she was going to fight this, and she's still fighting this to this day. I believe that there are other individuals. It's just that these are very small rural communities. We don't hear about them very much.
And there's not a lot of attention because you're going to go to the place where population is concentrated.
Exactly.
We did get a statement or response to questions from the Secretary of State's office. They said, quote, I told the reporter I couldn't directly account for the rate difference of investigation, we assume they're referring to, between rural and urban voters being investigated by the state election board. Some counties are cash strapped. I opine this lack of resources might contribute to reduced staffing and county-level training, but I cannot be sure. In your investigations, Tim, did you find a difference between the amount of resources and training that people receive in a rural area, especially in the county level?
I really didn't go to that level. The single election commission person I spoke with was in Coffee County, which is where the incident with Olivia Pearson occurred, and her response was, "It has nothing to do with that. Their poll workers are trained sufficiently, and end of story."
But this creates issues, especially for somebody who's concerned about voting fairness.
Yes.
What do we do about the focus on rural voters, and what, in your opinion at least, is causing it?
I first want to say first that I find it interesting there's a discussion about resources, yet the county has money to pursue her again for a second time.
Yeah, it's expensive.
And to answer your question, we should be about more democracy, not less. So I appreciate this morning's attention to this, and I think we need to pay more attention to it to shed a light on what's happening, particularly in these smaller communities. If this were Atlanta, I doubt that would have happened. But in a smaller place where
a city commissioner gets arrested and charged for helping their nephew?
Or helping someone who looked around the polling place and could not find a poll worker to assist them and asked Ms. Pearson, can you show me what do I do with this voter card? I don't see that happening in larger metropolitan areas. It just seems to be a bit more impactful in a smaller community, particularly if someone, and in my opinion, is targeted specifically for helping drive and get the vote out.
So to what extent is this part of the broader conversation? There's a lot of criticism of the GOP because they've encouraged citizens to lodge actually complaint, created a website dedicated for regular citizens to lodge voter fraud complaints. Now, the argument could be made that it's not legal to help someone unless they're either illiterate or disabled.
And that's an argument that can certainly be made. But are we telling people that you can't assist or tell someone or point to a poll worker and get someone's attention? How far are we going with this? In our democracy, I just fundamentally believe we should be about more of it, not less. And this is scaring people from voting. There were voters in the courtroom during Ms. Pearson's trial who said it's not worth it. That's something we should never hear in the United States.
If I can dovetail on that, Ms. Pearson also told me that she knew of cases where people said, well, since what's happened to you, I'm leery of voting.
Of voting at all?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Tim, Ms. Pearson is and not just on the city commission, she's an activist. And when you mentioned earlier that she said she was just doing what she's always done, what does that mean? What does she mean to what she has always done?
Well, she has helped people get to the polls. She's very active in the local politics. She speaks her mind, I would say, and that's my impression from talking to her. And other reporting has said that she, you know, she sees somebody on the side of the road who's going to the polls, she'll give them a ride, that sort of thing.
Again, with the statistics, we're talking about an investigation of voter fraud. I'm speaking with reporter Tim Merrima of the Daily Yonder and Atlanta-based voting rights consultant Fred McBride. And over a two-year period, that's 2015 and 2016, the State Election Board investigated rural voters at a rate of about one for every 23,000 votes. That's about twice the rate of urban voters. So, Fred, the groups that you've been involved in terms of voting, protecting voting rights, why haven't they been out in rural areas?
A lot of groups are making a start, and I won't say making a start. We go everywhere. We're talking about groups nationally. Oftentimes, resources make that a bit more difficult, but we have paid attention to not just metropolitan areas, but also rural areas. I just think we need more resources, more funding, and more attention in these places.
You clearly, I don't want to make assumptions, but it looks like you think Olivia Pearson should be, her case should be dismissed.
Absolutely.
So, but then how does one prosecute voter fraud if one is going to let things like this go?
You prosecute voter fraud when you find it. And so far, I have seen very few cases where undocumented residents or people are voting for people. It's not as common as people think, but you hear pundits argue voter fraud, we're addressing voter fraud. Where is it? We have been looking for years, and we cannot find consistent evidence of people voting for other people.
That is Fred McBride. He is an Atlanta-based voting rights consultant. We also spoke with reporter Tim Merrima of the Daily Yonder. You can find a link to Tim's reporting on voting violations in rural Georgia at gpbnews.org. Tim and Fred, thank you both so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Now let's head for the mountains. It's supposed to be way cooler up there this weekend anyway. Blue Ridge is a popular North Georgia getaway town, but it's also home to one of Georgia's largest populations of gay couples. And that's led to a rise in the number of LGBT-owned businesses. GPB's Emily Curitan sent us this postcard from Main Street.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My name is Marv Barton, and I work at the Blue Ridge Olive Oil Company in Blue Ridge, Georgia.
Y'all find everything all right?
We are.
I didn't want to tilt.
When I first moved up here 29 years ago, all my friends in Atlanta said, you know, that's almost like a death sentence moving to the mountains. You know, a backward community, you know, you're putting your life in danger. We never encountered, me and my partner have been together 47 years. Both of us own businesses in this area, and we never encountered any difficulty at all. Some friends did, but up here, it's much easier because a large number of gay men, lesbian women are moving up here, buying properties and opening businesses.
Appreciate it. See you.
I'm not loving this. Did you taste this? My name is Sarah Almond, and I am a wine and cheese and beer purveyor in Blue Ridge. My shop is called Out of the Blue.
Let's this get is a new glass. This is a new glass.
Oh, well, I already know I'm not loving that. I'm tasting wines right now to see what'll be in the shop next week.
Small producer.
Yum. I tell people, they ask if I'm local, and I laugh and say, no, I'm not, but I got here as quick as I could. We are in the foothills of the oldest mountains in the world. I think there's some cool mojo going on about that, and I think that draws a lot of interesting and open-minded people, and it has proven to be true in my instance for certain. I have been gay longer than my parents have been married. I mean, you know, it was born that way, and it's never been a problem. The hardest part was, of course, telling your parents when you're 20 years old. But after that, it's who you are. Not everybody can be lucky enough to be gay. There are hard parts about it. But there are hard parts about being a human.
Good, you can have that one, and I'll have this one. I'm not doing that one, I already know.
I appreciate your patience.
Of course.
I am Jack Morton. I am living in Blue Ridge, Georgia, that I love very much. And we are sitting here in my studio where I do hair makeup for a lot of clients, such as I did in Atlanta. And this is probably one of the warmest communities you'll ever visit. And this old bus station has been completely resurrected into a new business, as many of the old buildings downtown have been and are being done as we speak. I would say at least 6 or 7 businesses downtown are LGBT owned and operated. If you go down Main Street, you could come back in 2 months and it would look different to you because there's that much of an influx.
How bad is it today?
It's not bad.
Okay, good.
Nope, your ends aren't that bad at all.
Good. I'm Sharon Davenport. My husband and I just moved here from Atlanta about a year ago, and we've just fallen in love with the town.
You know, what's really interesting is how we met. I was at the grocery store grocery shopping, and she and her husband were there. And I was thinking to myself, wow, what a really handsome couple. And he has very long hair, which is beautiful. And since I do hair, of course, I was attracted to both of them, you know, with their hair. And we just started having conversation. And that's how we met.
I mean, that kind of thing just never happened in Atlanta. You don't start talking to people in the grocery store. Oh, no, I love it. I love that.
Yeah, it was great.
The town of Blue Ridge is about 10 miles from the Tennessee border in Georgia's beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. Our guide for that visit, GPB's Emily Curitan. That's our show for today. We talked about how Georgia's electorate is changing, and we want to hear from you. What issues do you care about the most when you vote? Maybe it's the economy, maybe it's roads, maybe it's education. Tell us what your priority is in the voting booth. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Ryan McFadden, and Trevor Young. Our senior producer is Emily Curitan. Our interns are Candace Bates and Charles Lucas. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.